Have you got any money? Crystal demanded. What? Said Fats. His wits were slow with tiredness. He could not remember now why he'd wanted to sit up all night. His tongue was throbbing with all the cigarettes he had smoked.
Money, repeated Crystal. He's hungry and I've lost a fiver. Pay you back.
Fats stuck a hand in his jeans pocket and touched a crumpled banknote. Somehow he did not want to look too flush in front of Crystal, so he ferreted deeper for change and finally came up with a small amount of silver and coppers. They went to the tiny newsagents two streets from the square, and Fats hung around outside while Crystal bought Robbie crisps and a packet of Rolos. None of them said a word, not even Robbie, who seemed fearful of Fats. At last, when Crystal had handed her brother the crisps, she said to Fats, "Where will we go?" Surely, he thought, she could not mean that they were going to shag. Not with a boy there. He had had some idea of taking her to the cubbyhole. It was private, and it would be a final desecration of his and Andrew's friendship. He owed nothing to anyone anymore. But he balked at the idea of fucking in front of a three-year-old.
"He'll be all right," said Crystal. "He's got chocolates now."
"No, later," she said to Robbie, who was whining for the Rolos still in her hand, "when you've had the crisps."
They walked off down the road in the direction of the old stone bridge.
"He'll be all right," Crystal repeated. "He does as he's told, don't you?" she said loudly to Robbie. "Want chocolates?" he said. "Yeah, in a minute."
She could tell that Fats needed cajoling today. She had known on the bus that bringing Robbie, however necessary, would be difficult.
"What you been up to?" she asked.
"Party last night," said Fats.
"Yeah, who was there?"
He yawned widely, and she had to wait for an answer. "Half Price, Sukhvinder Jawanda, Gaia Borden."
"Does she live in Padford?"
asked Crystal sharply.
"Yeah, in Hope Street," said Fats. He knew because Andrew had let it slip where she lived.
Andrew had never said that he liked her, but Fats had watched him watching Gaia almost constantly in the few classes they shared. He had noticed Andrew's extreme self-consciousness around her and whenever she was mentioned. Crystal, though, was thinking about Gaia's mother, the only social worker she had ever liked, the only one who had got through to her mother. She lived in Hope Street, the same as Nana Kath. She was probably there right now. What if... But Kay had left them. Matty was their social worker again. Anyway, you weren't supposed to bother them at home. Shane Tully had once followed his social worker to her house, and he'd got a restraining order for his pains. But then Shane had earlier tried to heave a brick through the woman's car window. And, Crystal reasoned, squinting as the road turned and the river dazzled her eyes with thousands of blinding white spots of light, Kay was still the keeper of folders, the scorekeeper and the judge. She had seemed all right, but none of her solutions would keep Crystal and Robbie together.
"We could go down there,"
she suggested to Fats, pointing at the overgrown stretch of bank, a little way along from the bridge. "And Robbie could wait up there on the bench." She would be able to keep an eye on him from there, she thought, and she would make sure he didn't see anything. Not that it was anything he'd not seen before, in the days that Terry brought strangers home. But, exhausted as he was, Fats was revolted. He could not do it in the grass, under the eye of a small boy. "Nah," he said, trying to sound offhand.
"He won't bother," said Crystal. "He's got his Rolos. He won't even know," she said.
Although she thought that was a lie. Robbie knew too much. There had been trouble at nursery when he'd mimicked doing it doggy style on another child. Crystal's mother, Fats remembered, was a prostitute. He hated the idea of what she was suggesting. But was it not inauthenticity?
"What's the matter?"
Crystal asked him aggressively. "Nothing," he said. "Dane Tully would do it. Pikey Pritchard would do it. Cubby, not in a million years. Crystal walked Robbie to the bench. Fats bent to peer over the back of it, down to the overgrown patch of weeds and bushes, and thought that the kid might not see anything, but that he would be quick as he could in any case. "Here you are," Crystal told Robbie, pulling out the long tube of Rolos while he reached for them excitedly. "You can have all of them if you just sit here for a minute, all right? You just sit here, Robbie, and I'll be in them bushes. Do you understand, Robbie?"
"Yeah,"
he said happily, his cheeks already full of chocolate and toffee. Crystal slipped and slid down the bank towards the patch of undergrowth, hoping that Fats was not going to make any difficulties about doing it without a condom. 10. Gavin was wearing sunglasses against the glare of the morning sun, but that was no disguise. Samantha Mollison was sure to recognize his car. When he caught sight of her, striding along the pavement, alone, with her hands in her pockets and her head down, Gavin made a sharp left turn and, instead of continuing along the road to Mary's, crossed the old stone bridge and parked up a side lane on the other side of the river. He did not want Samantha to see him parking outside Mary's house. It did not matter on work days, when he wore a suit and carried a briefcase. It had not mattered before he had admitted to himself what he felt about Mary. But it mattered now. In any case, the morning was glorious, and a walk bought him time. "Still keeping my options open," he thought, as he crossed the bridge on foot. There was a small boy sitting by himself on a bench, eating sweets below him. "I don't have to say anything. I'll play it by ear." But his palms were wet. The thought of Gaia telling the Fairbrother twins that he was in love with their mother had haunted him all through a restless night. Mary seemed pleased to see him. "Where's your car?" she asked, peering over his shoulder. "Parked it down by the river," he said. "Lovely morning. I fancied a walk. And then it occurred to me that I could mow the lawn if you..." "Oh, Graham did it for me," she said. "But that's so sweet of you. Come in and have a coffee." She chatted as she moved around the kitchen. She was wearing old cut-off jeans and a t-shirt. They showed how thin she was. But her hair was shiny again, the way he usually thought of it. He could see the twin girls lying out on the freshly mown lawn on a blanket, both with headphones in, listening to their iPods. "How are you?" Mary asked, sitting down beside him. He could not think why she sounded so concerned. Then he remembered that he had found time to tell her, yesterday, during his brief visit, that he and Kay had split up. "I'm okay," he said. "Probably for the best." She smiled and patted his arm. "I heard last night," he said, his mouth a little dry, "that you might be moving." "News travels fast in Pagford," she said. "It's just an idea. Teresa wants me to move back to Liverpool." "And how do the kids feel about that?"
"Well, I'd wait for the girls and Fergus to do their exams in June. Declan's not so much of a problem. I mean, none of us wants to leave."
She melted into tears in front of him. But he was so happy that he reached out to touch her delicate wrist.
"Of course you don't.
Barry's grave."
"Ah," said Gavin, his happiness snuffed out like a candle. Mary wiped her streaming eyes on the back of her hand. Gavin found her a little morbid. His family cremated their dead. Barry's burial had only been the second he had ever attended, and he had hated everything about it. Gavin saw a grave purely as a marker for the place where a corpse was decomposing. A nasty thought. Yet people took it into their heads to visit and bring flowers, as though it might yet recover. She had got up to get tissues. Outside on the lawn, the twins had switched to sharing a set of headphones, their heads bobbing up and down in time to the same song.
"So Miles got Barry's seat," she said. "I could hear the celebrations all the way up here last night."
"Well, it was Howard's..." "Yeah, that's right," said Gavin.
"And Pagford's nearly rid of the fields," she said.
"Yeah, looks like it."
And now Mars is on the council, it'll be easier to close Bellchapel, she said.
Gavin always had to remind himself what Bellchapel was. He had no interest in these issues at all.
Yeah, I suppose so.
So, everything Barry wanted is finished, she said. Her tears had dried up, and the patches of high, angry colour had returned to her cheeks.
I know, he said. It's really sad.
I don't know, she said, still flushed and angry. Why should Pagford pick up the bills for the fields? Barry only ever saw one side of it. He thought everyone in the fields was like him. He thought Crystal Whedon was like him, but she wasn't. It never occurred to him that people in the fields might be happy where they are.
Yeah, said Gavin, overjoyed that she disagreed with Barry, and feeling as if the shadow of his grave had lifted from between them.
I know what you mean. From all I've heard about Crystal Whedon, she got more of his time and his attention than his own daughters, said Mary, and she never even gave a penny for his wreath. The girls told me the whole rowing crew chipped in, except Crystal, and she didn't come to his funeral even, after all he'd done for her.
Yeah, well, that shows.
I'm sorry, but I can't help thinking about it all, she said frenetically. I can't stop thinking that he'd still want me to worry about bloody Crystal Whedon. I can't get past it. All the last day of his life. And he had a headache, and he didn't do anything about it. Writing that bloody article.
I know, said Gavin. I know. I think, he said, with a sense of putting his foot tentatively on an old rope bridge, it's a bloke thing. Miles is the same. Samantha didn't want him to stand for the council, but he went ahead anyway. You know, some men really like a bit of power.
Barry wasn't in it for power, said Mary, and Gavin hastily retreated.
No, no, Barry wasn't. He was in it for... He couldn't help himself, she said. He thought everyone was like him, that if you gave them a hand, they'd start bettering themselves.
Yeah, said Gavin. But the point is, there are other people who could use a hand. People at home.
Well, exactly, said Mary,
dissolving yet again into tears.
Mary, said Gavin, leaving his chair, moving to her side, on the rope bridge now, with a sense of mingled panic and anticipation.
Look, it's really early. I mean, it's far too soon, but you'll meet someone else.
At 40, sobbed Mary,
with 4 children.
Plenty of men, he began, but that was no good. He would rather she did not think she had too many options.
The right man, he corrected himself, won't care that you've got kids. Anyway, they're such nice kids. Anyone would be glad to take them on.
Oh, Gavin, you're so sweet, she said, dabbing her eyes again.
He put his arm around her, and she did not shrug it off. They stood without speaking while she blew her nose, and then he felt her tense to move away, and he said,
Mary,
what?
I've got to...
Mary, I think I'm in love with you.
He knew for a few seconds the glorious pride of the skydiver who pushes off firm floor into limitless space. Then she pulled away.
Gavin, I'm sorry, he said, observing with alarm her repulsed expression.
I wanted you to hear it from me. I told Kay that's why I wanted to split up, and I was scared you'd hear it from someone else. I wouldn't have said anything for months, years, he added, trying to bring back her smile and the mood in which she found him sweet.
But Mary was shaking her head, arms folded over her thin chest.
Gavin, I never, ever...
Forget I said anything, he said, foolishly. Let's just forget it.
I thought you understood, she said.
He gathered that he should have known that she was encased in the invisible armour of grief, and that it ought to have protected her.
I do understand, he lied. I wouldn't have told you, only...
Barry always said you fancied me, said Mary.
I didn't, he said, frantically. Gavin, I think you're such a nice man, she said, breathlessly. But I don't... I mean, even if...
No, he said loudly, trying to drown her out. I understand. Listen, I'm going to go.
There's no need.
But he almost hated her now. He had heard what she was trying to say. Even if I weren't grieving for my husband, I wouldn't want you. His visit had been so brief that when Mary, slightly shaky, poured away his coffee, it was still hot.
11. Howard had told Shirley that he did not feel well, that he thought he had better stay in bed and rest, and that the copper kettle could run without him for an afternoon. I'll call Mo, he said.
No, I'll call her, said Shirley, sharply.
As she closed the bedroom door on him, Shirley thought, he's using his heart. He had said, don't be silly, Cheryl, and then, it's rubbish, bloody rubbish. And she had not pressed him. Years of genteel avoidance of grisly topics, Shirley had been literally struck dumb when 23-year-old Patricia had said, I'm gay, Mum, seemed to have muzzled something inside her. The doorbell rang. Lexi said, Dad told me to come round here. He and Mum have got something to do. Where's Grandad?
In bed, said Shirley. He overdid it a bit last night.
It was a good party, wasn't it? Said Lexi.
Yes, lovely, said Shirley, with a tempest building inside her. After a while, her granddaughter's prattling wore Shirley down.
Let's have lunch at the cafe, she suggested.
Howard, she called through the closed bedroom door, I'm taking Lexi for lunch at the Copper Kettle.
He sounded worried, and she was glad. She was not afraid of Maureen. She would look Maureen right in the face. But it occurred to Shirley, as she walked, that Howard might have telephoned Maureen the moment she had left the bungalow. She was so stupid. Somehow she had thought that, in calling Maureen herself about Howard's illness, she had stopped them communicating. She was forgetting. The familiar, well-loved streets seemed different, strange. She had taken a regular inventory of the windows she presented to this lovely little world. Wife and mother, hospital volunteer, secretary to the parish council, first citizeness, and Pagford had been her mirror, reflecting in its polite respect her value and her worth. But the ghost had taken a rubber stamp and smeared across the pristine surface of her life a revelation that would nullify it all. Her husband was sleeping with his business partner, and she never knew. It would be all that anyone said when she was mentioned, all that they ever remembered about her. She pushed open the door of the cafe. The bell tinkled, and Lexi said, There's Peanut Price.
Howard all right?
croaked Maureen.
Just tired, said Shirley, moving smoothly to a table and sitting down, her heart beating so fast that she wondered whether she might have a coronary herself.
Tell him neither of the girls has turned up, said Maureen crossly, lingering by their table. And neither of them bothered to call in either. It's lucky we're not busy.
Lexi went to the counter to talk to Andrew, who had been put on waiter duty. Conscious of her unusual solitude, as she sat alone at the table, Shirley remembered Mary Fairbrother, erect and gaunt at Barry's funeral, widowhood draped around her like a queen's train, the pity, the admiration. In losing her husband, Mary had become the silent, passive recipient of admiration, whereas she, shackled to a man who had betrayed her, was cloaked in grubbiness, a target of derision. Long ago in Yarville, men had subjected Shirley to smutty jokes because of her mother's reputation, even though she, Shirley, had been as pure as it was possible to be.
Grandad's feeling ill, Lexi was telling Andrew. What's in those cakes?
He bent down behind the counter, hiding his red face.
I snogged your mum.
Andrew had almost skived off work. He had been afraid that Howard might sack him on the spot for kissing his daughter-in-law and was downright terrified that Miles Mollison might storm in looking for him. At the same time, he was not so naive that he did not know that Samantha, who must, he thought ruthlessly, be well over 40, would figure as the villain of the piece. His defence was simple. She was pissed, and she grabbed me. There was a tiny glimmer of pride in his embarrassment. He had been anxious to see Gaia. He wanted to tell her that a grown woman had pounced on him. He had hoped that they might laugh about it, the way that they had laughed about Maureen, but that she might be secretly impressed, and also that in the course of laughing, he might find out exactly what she had done with Fats, how far she had let him go. He was prepared to forgive her. She had been pissed too. But she had not turned up. He went to fetch a napkin for Lexi and almost collided with his boss's wife, who was standing behind the counter, holding his EpiPen. "Herod wanted me to check something," Shirley told him. "And this needle shouldn't be kept in here. I'll put it in the back." 12. Halfway down his packet of Rolos, Robbie became extremely thirsty. Crystal had not bought him a drink. He climbed off the bench and crouched down in the warm grass, where he could still see her outline in the bushes with the stranger. After a while, he scrambled down the bank towards them.
"I'm thirsty," he whined.
"Robbie, get out of it," screamed Crystal. "Go and sit on the bench."
"Want a drink?"
"Fucking go and wait by the bench and I'll get her a drink in a minute. Go away, Robbie."
Crying, he climbed back up the slippery bank to the bench. He was accustomed to not being given what he wanted, and disobedient by habit, because grown-ups were arbitrary in their wrath and their rules, so he had learned to seize his tiny pleasures wherever and whenever he could. Angry at Crystal, he wandered a little way from the bench along the road. A man in sunglasses was walking along the pavement towards him. Gavin had forgotten where he'd parked the car. He had marched out of Mary's and walked straight down Church Row, only realizing that he was heading in the wrong direction when he drew level with Miles and Samantha's house. Not wanting to pass the Fairbrothers again, he had taken a circuitous route back to the bridge. He saw the boy, chocolate-stained, ill-kempt and unappealing, and walked past, with his happiness in tatters, half wishing that he could have gone to Kay's house and been silently cradled. She had always been nicest to him when he was miserable. It was what had attracted him to her in the first place. The rushing of the river increased Robbie's thirst. He cried a bit more as he changed direction and headed away from the bridge, back past the place where Crystal was hidden. The bushes had started shaking. He walked on, wanting a drink, then noticed a hole in a long hedge on the left of the road. When he drew level, he spotted a playing field beyond. Robbie wiggled through the hole and contemplated the wide green space with its spreading chestnut tree and goalposts. Robbie knew what they were, because his cousin Dane had showed him how to kick a football at the play park. He had never seen so much greenness. A woman came striding across the field with her arms folded and her head bowed. Samantha had been walking at random, walking and walking, anywhere as long as it was nowhere near Church Row. She had been asking herself many questions and coming up with few answers, and one of the questions she asked herself was whether she might not have gone too far in telling Miles about that stupid, drunken letter which she had sent out of spite, and which seemed much less clever now. She glanced up and her eyes met Robbie's. Children often wriggled through the hole in the hedge to play in the field at weekends. Her own girls had done it when they were younger. She climbed over the gate and turned away from the river towards the square. Self-disgust clung to her, no matter how hard she tried to outrun it. Robbie went back through the hole in the hedge and walked a little way along the road after the striding lady, but she was soon out of sight. The half packet of remaining Rolos were melting in his hand, and he did not want to put them down, but he was so thirsty. Maybe Crystal had finished. He wandered back in the opposite direction, When he reached the first patch of bushes on the bank, he saw that they were not moving, so he thought it was all right to approach.
Crystal,
he said. But the bushes were empty. Crystal was gone. Robbie started to wail and shout for Crystal. He clambered back up the bank and looked wildly up and down the road, but there was no sign of her.
Crystal!
He yelled. A woman with short silver hair glanced at him, frowning, as she trotted briskly along the opposite pavement. Shirley had left Lexi at the Copper Kettle, where she seemed happy, but a short way across the square she had caught a glimpse of Samantha, who was the very last person she wanted to meet, so she had taken off in the opposite direction. The boys' wails and squawks echoed behind her as she hurried along. Shirley's fist was clutched tightly around the EpiPen in her pocket. She would not be a dirty joke. She wanted to be pure and pitied, like Mary Fairbrother. Her rage was so enormous, so dangerous, that she could not think coherently. She wanted to act, to punish, to finish. Just before the old stone bridge, a patch of bushes shivered to Shirley's left. She glanced down and caught a disgusting glimpse of something sordid and vile, and it drove her on. 13. Sukhvinder had been walking around Pagford longer than Samantha. She had left the old vicarage shortly after her mother had told her she must go to work, and since then she had been wandering the streets, observing invisible exclusion zones around Church Row, Hope Street, and the Square. She had nearly £50 in her pocket, which represented her wages from the cafe and the party, and the razor. She had wanted to take her building society passbook, which resided in a little filing cabinet in her father's study, but Vikram had been at his desk. She had waited for a while at the bus stop, where you could catch a bus into Yarville, but then she had spotted Shirley and Lexi Mollison coming down the road, and dived out of sight. Gaia's betrayal had been brutal and unexpected. Pulling Fat's wool. He would drop Crystal now that he had Gaia. Any boy would drop any girl for Gaia, she knew that. But she could not bear to go to work and hear her one ally trying to tell her that Fats was all right, really. Her mobile buzzed. Gaia had already texted her twice. How pissed was I last night? Are you going to work? Nothing about Fats Wall. Nothing about snogging Sukhvinder's torturer. The new message said, are you okay? Sukhvinder put the mobile back into her pocket. She might walk towards Yarville and catch a bus outside town where nobody would see her. Her parents would not miss her until 5:30, when they expected her home from the cafe. A desperate plan formed as she walked, hot and tired. If she could find a place to stay that cost less than £50... All she wanted was to be alone and ply her razor blade. She was on the river road with the oar flowing beside her. If she crossed the bridge, she would be able to take a back street all the way round to the start of the bypass.
Robbie! Robbie! Where are you?
It was Crystal Whedon running up and down the riverbank. Fats Wall was smoking with one hand in his pocket, watching Crystal run. Sukhvinder took a sharp right onto the bridge, terrified that one of them might notice her. Crystal's yells were echoing off the rushing water. Sukhvinder caught sight of something in the river below. Her hands were already on the hot stone ledge before she had thought about what she was doing, and then she had hoisted herself onto the edge of the bridge. She yelled, "He's in the river, Chris!" and dropped feet first into the water. Her leg was sliced open by a broken computer monitor as she was pulled under by the current. 14. When Shirley opened the bedroom door, she saw nothing but two empty beds. Justice required a sleeping Howard. She would have to advise him to return to bed. but there was no sound from either the kitchen or the bathroom. Shirley was worried that by taking the river road home, she had missed him. He must have got dressed and set off for work. He might already be with Maureen in the back room, discussing Shirley, planning perhaps to divorce her and marry Maureen instead, now that the game was up and pretense was ended. She half ran into the sitting room, intending to telephone the copper kettle. Howard was lying on the carpet in his pyjamas. His face was purple and his eyes were popping. A faint wheezing noise came from his lips. One hand was clutching feebly at his chest. His pyjama top had ridden up. Shirley could see the very patch of scabbed raw skin where she had planned to plunge the needle. Howard's eyes met hers in mute appeal. Shirley stared at him, terrified, then darted out of the room. At first, she hid the EpiPen in the biscuit barrel. Then she retrieved it and shoved it down the back of the cookery books. She ran back into the sitting room, seized the telephone receiver, and dialed 999.
Packford? This is for Orbank Cottage, is it? There's one on the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank God,
said Shirley. And she had almost hung up when she realized what she had said and screamed,
No, no, not Orbank Cottage.
But the operator had gone, and she had to dial again. She was panicking so much that she dropped the receiver. On the carpet beside her, Howard's wheezing was becoming fainter and fainter.
Not Orbank Cottage, she shouted. 36 Evertree Crescent, Pagford. My husband's having a heart attack.
15. In Church Row, Miles Mollison came tearing out of his house in bedroom slippers and sprinted down the steep sloping pavement to the old vicarage on the corner. He banged on the thick oak door with his left hand while trying to dial his wife's number with his right.
Yes, said Parminda, opening the door.
My dad, gasped Miles. Another heart attack. Mum's called an ambulance. Will you come? Please, will you come?
Parminda made a swift move back into the house, mentally seizing her doctor's bag, but checked.
I can't. I'm suspended from work, Miles. I can't.
You're joking. Please, the ambulance won't be here for...
I can't, Miles, she said.
He turned and ran away from her through the open gate. Ahead, he saw Samantha walking up their garden path. He called to her, his voice breaking, and she turned in surprise. At first, she thought that his panic was on her account.
Dad, collapsed. There's an ambulance coming. Bloody Parminda Jawanda won't come.
My God, said Samantha. Oh, my God.
They dashed to the car and drove up the road, Miles in his slippers, Samantha in the clogs that had blistered her feet.
Miles, listen, there's a siren. It's here already.
But when they turned into Evertree Crescent, there was nothing there, and the siren was already gone. On a lawn a mile away, Sukhvinder Jawanda was vomiting river water beneath a willow tree, while an old lady pressed blankets around her that were already as sodden as Sukhvinder's clothes. A short distance away, the dog walker who had dragged Sukhvinder from the river by her hair and her sweatshirt was bent over a small, limp body. Sukhvinder had thought she felt Robbie struggling in her arms, but had that been the cruel tug of the river, trying to rip him from her? She was a strong swimmer, but the oar had dragged her under, pulled her helplessly wherever it chose. She had been swept around the bend, and it had thrown her in towards land, and she had managed to scream and seen the man with his dog running towards her along the bank. No good, said the man who had worked on Robbie's little body for 20 minutes. He's gone. Sukhvinder wailed and slumped to the cold, wet ground, shaking furiously as the sound of the siren reached them too late. Back in Evertree Crescent, the paramedics were having enormous difficulty getting Howard onto the stretcher. Miles and Samantha had to help.
We'll follow in the car. You go with Dad,
Miles shouted at Shirley, who seemed bewildered and unwilling to get into the ambulance. Maureen, who had just shown her last customer out of the copper kettle, stood on the doorstep, listening.
"Lots of sirens,"
she said over her shoulder to an exhausted Andrew who was mopping tables.
"Something must have happened."
And she took a deep breath, as though she hoped to taste the tang of disaster on the warm afternoon air. Part 6. Weaknesses of Voluntary Bodies. 22-23. The main weaknesses of such bodies are that they are hard to launch, liable to disintegrate. Charles Arnold Baker, Local Council Administration, 7th edition. 1. Many, many times had Colin Wall imagined the police coming to his door. They arrived at last at dusk on Sunday evening, a woman and a man, not to arrest Colin, but to look for his son. A fatal accident, and Stuart, is it? Was a witness. Is he at home?
No, said Tessa. Oh, dear God. Robbie Whedon. But he lives in the fields. Why was he here?
The policewoman explained kindly what they believed to have happened.
The teenagers took their eye off him,
was the phrase she used. Tessa thought she might faint. You don't know where Stuart is? Asked the policeman.
No,
said Colin, gaunt and shadow-eyed.
Where was he last seen?
When our colleague pulled up, Stuart seems to have, run away.
Oh, dear God,
said Tessa again. He's not answering, said Colin, calmly. He had already dialed Fats on his mobile.
We'll need to go and look for him.
Colin had rehearsed for Calamity all his life. He was ready. He took down his coat.
I'll try Arf,
said Tessa, running to the telephone. Isolated above the little town, no news of the calamities had yet reached Hilltop House. Andrew's mobile rang in the kitchen.
Hello,
he said, his mouth full of toast.
Andy, it's Tessa Wall. Is Stu with you?
No, he said. Sorry. But he was not at all sorry that Fats was not with him.
Something's happened, Andy. Stu was down at the river with Crystal Whedon, and she had her little brother with her, and the boys drowned. Stu's run off somewhere. Can you think where he might be?
No, said Andrew automatically, because that was his and Fats's code. Never tell the parents. But the horror of what she had just told him crept through the phone like a clammy fog. Everything was suddenly less clear, less certain. She was about to hang up.
Wait, Mrs. Wall, he said.
I might know. There's a place down by the river.
I don't think he'd go near the river now, said Tessa.
Seconds flicked by, and Andrew was more and more convinced that Fats was in the cubby hole.
It's the only place I can think of, he said. Tell me where.
I'd have to show you.
I'll be there in 10 minutes, she shouted.
Colin was already patrolling the streets of Pagford on foot. Tessa drove the Nissan up the winding hill road and found Andrew waiting for her on the corner where he usually caught the bus. He directed her down through the town. The street lights were feeble by twilight. They parked by the trees where Andrew usually threw down Simon's racing bike. Tessa got out of the car and followed Andrew to the edge of the water, puzzled and frightened.
He's not here, she said.
It's along there, said Andrew, pointing at the sheer dark face of Pargeter Hill, running straight down to the river with barely a lip of bank before the rushing water.
What do you mean?
Asked Tessa, horrified. Andrew had known from the first that she would not be able to come with him. Short and dumpy as she was.
I'll go and see, he said, if you wait here. But it's too dangerous, she cried over the roar of the powerful river.
Ignoring her, he reached for the familiar hand and footholds. As he inched away along the tiny ledge, the same thought came to both of them. that Fats might have fallen or jumped into the river thundering so close at Andrew's feet. Tessa remained at the water's edge until she could not make Andrew out any longer, then turned away, trying not to cry in case Stuart was there and she needed to talk to him calmly. For the first time she wondered where Crystal was. The police had not said, and her terror for Fats had obliterated every other concern.
"Please, God, let me find Stuart," she prayed. "Let me find Stuart, please, God."
Then she pulled her mobile from her cardigan pocket and called Kay Borden.
"I don't know whether you've heard," she shouted over the rushing water,
and she told Kay the story.
"But I'm not her social worker anymore," said Kay.
20 feet away, Andrew had reached the cubbyhole. It was pitch black. He had never been here this late. He swung himself inside. "Fats?" He heard something move at the back of the hole. "Fats, you there?"
"Got a light off,"
said an unrecognizable voice.
"I dropped my bloody matches."
Andrew thought of shouting out to Tessa, but she did not know how long it took to reach the cubbyhole. She could wait a few more moments. He passed over his lighter. By its flickering flame, Andrew saw that his friend's appearance was almost as changed as his voice. Fats's eyes were swollen. His whole face looked puffy. The flame went out. Fats's cigarette tip glowed bright in the darkness.
"Is he dead?"
"Her brother."
Andrew had not realized that Fats did not know.
"Yeah,"
he said. And then he added,
"I think so. That's what I heard."
There was a silence, and then a soft, piglet-like squeal reached him through the darkness.
"Mrs. Wall!"
yelled Andrew, sticking his head out of the hole as far as it would go so that he could not hear Fats's sobs over the sound of the river.
"Mrs. Wall, he's here!"
2. The policewoman had been gentle and kind in the cluttered cottage by the river, where dank water now covered blankets, chintzy chairs and worn rugs. The old lady who owned the place had brought a hot water bottle and a cup of boiling tea, which Sukhvinder could not lift because she was shaking like a drill. She had disgorged chunks of information, her own name and Crystal's name, and the name of the dead little boy that they were loading onto an ambulance. The dog walker who had pulled her from the river was rather deaf. He gave a statement to the police in the next room, and Sukhvinder hated the sound of his bellowed account. He had tethered his dog to a tree outside the window, and it whined persistently. Then the police had called her parents, and they had come, Parminder knocking over a table and smashing one of the old lady's ornaments as she crossed the room with clean clothes in her arms. In the tiny bathroom, the deep, dirty gash on Sukhvinder's leg was revealed, peppering the fluffy bath mat with black spots. And when Parminder saw the wound, she shrieked at Vikram, who was thanking everyone loudly in the hall, that they must take Sukhvinder to the hospital. She had vomited again in the car, and her mother, who was beside her in the back seat, had mopped her up. And all the way there, Parminder and Vikram had kept up a flow of loud talk. Her father kept repeating himself, saying things like, "She'll need a sedative," and "That cut will definitely need stitches." And Parminder, who was in the back seat with the shaking and retching Sukhvinder, kept saying, "You might have died, you might have died." It was as if she was still underwater. Sukhvinder was somewhere she could not breathe. She tried to cut through it all to be heard.
"Does Crystal know he's dead?"
she asked through chattering teeth, and Parminder had to ask her to repeat the question several times.
"I don't know," she answered at last. "You might have died, Jolly."
At the hospital, they made her undress again, but this time her mother was with her in the curtained cubicle, and she realized her mistake too late when she saw the expression of horror on Parminder's face.
"My God,"
she said, grabbing Sukhvinder's forearm.
"My God, what have you done to yourself?"
Sukhvinder had no words, so she allowed herself to subside into tears and uncontrollable shaking, and Vikram shouted at everyone, including Parminder, to leave her alone, but also to damn well hurry up, and that her cut needed cleaning and she needed stitches and sedatives and x-rays. Later, they put her in a bed with a parent on each side of her, and both of them stroked her hands. She was warm and numb, and there was no pain in her leg anymore. The sky beyond the windows was dark.
"Howard Mollison's had another heart attack," she heard her mother tell her father. "Miles wanted me to go to him."
"Bloody nerve," said Vikram. To Sukhvinder's drowsy surprise, they talked no more about Howard Mollison. They merely continued to stroke her hands until, shortly afterwards, she fell asleep. On the far side of the building, in a shabby blue room with plastic chairs and a fish tank in the corner, Miles and Samantha were sitting on either side of Shirley, waiting for news from theatre. Miles was still wearing his slippers.
"I can't believe Parminder Chawanda wouldn't come," he said for the umpteenth time, his voice cracking.
Samantha got up, moved past Shirley, and put her arms around Miles, kissing his thick hair, speckled with grey, breathing in his familiar smell. Shirley said in a high, strangled voice,
"I'm not surprised she wouldn't come. I'm not surprised. Absolutely appalling."
All she had left of her old life and her old certainties was attacking familiar targets. Shock had taken almost everything from her. She no longer knew what to believe or even what to hope. The man in theatre was not the man she had thought she had married. If she could have returned to that happy place of certainty before she had read that awful post, perhaps she ought to shut down the whole website, take away the message boards in their entirety. She was afraid that the ghost might come back, that he might say the awful thing again. She wanted to go home, right now, and disable the website, and while there, she could destroy the EpiPen once and for all.
"He saw it. I know he saw it. But I'd never have done it, really. I wouldn't have done it. I was upset. I'd never have done it."
What if Howard survived and his first words were, "She ran out of the room when she saw me. She didn't call an ambulance straight away. She was holding a big needle."
"Then I'll say his brain's been affected,"
Shirley thought defiantly. "And if he died..." Beside her, Samantha was hugging Miles. Shirley did not like it. She ought to be the centre of attention. It was her husband who was lying upstairs, fighting for his life. She had wanted to be like Mary Fairbrother, cosseted and admired, a tragic heroine. This was not how she had imagined it.
"Shirley?"
Ruth Price, in her nurse's uniform, had come hurrying into the room, her thin face forlorn with sympathy.
"I just heard. I had to come. Shirley, how awful. I'm so sorry."
"Ruth, dear,"
said Shirley, getting up and allowing herself to be embraced.
"That's so kind. So kind."
Shirley liked introducing her medical friends to Miles and Samantha, and receiving her pity and her kindness in front of them. It was a tiny taste of how she had imagined widowhood. But then Ruth had to go back to work, and Shirley returned to her plastic chair and her uncomfortable thoughts.
"He'll be okay,"
Samantha was murmuring to Miles, as he rested his head on her shoulder.
"I know he'll pull through. He did last time."
Shirley watched little neon-bright fish darting hither and thither in their tank. It was the past that she wished she could change. The future was a blank.
"Has anyone phoned Mo?"
Miles asked after a while, wiping his eyes on the back of one hand while the other gripped Samantha's leg. "Mum,
Do you want me to?
No, said Shirley sharply.
But wait.
Until we know.
In the theatre upstairs, Howard Mollison's body overflowed the edges of the operating table. His chest was wide open, revealing the ruins of Vikram Jawanda's handiwork. 19 people laboured to repair the damage, while the machines to which Howard was connected made soft, implacable noises, confirming that he continued to live. And far below, in the bowels of the hospital, Robbie Whedon's body lay frozen and white in the morgue. Nobody had accompanied him to the hospital, and nobody had visited him in his metal drawer.
3.
Andrew had refused a lift back to Hilltop House, so it was only Tessa and Fats in the car together. And Fats said, I don't want to go home.
All right, Tessa replied, and she drove, while talking to Colin on the telephone.
I've got him.
Andy found him. We'll be back in a bit.
Yes.
Yes, I will.
Tears were spattering down Fats's face. His body was betraying him. It was exactly like the time when hot urine had spilt down his leg into his sock, when Simon Price had made him piss himself. The hot saltiness leaked over his chin and onto his chest, pattering like drops of rain. He kept imagining the funeral, a tiny little coffin. He had not wanted to do it with the boy so near. Would the weight of the dead child ever lift from him?
So you ran away, said Tessa coldly over his tears.
She had prayed that she would find him alive, but her strongest emotion was disgust. His tears did not soften her. She was used to men's tears. Part of her was ashamed that he had not, after all, thrown himself into the river.
Crystal told the police that you and she were in the bushes. You just left him to his own devices, did you?
Fats was speechless. He could not believe her cruelty. Did she not understand the desolation roaring inside him, the horror, the sense of contagion?
Well, I hope you have got her pregnant, said Tessa. It'll give her something to live for.
Every time they turned a corner, he thought that she was taking him home. He had feared Cubby most, but now there was nothing to choose between his parents. He wanted to get out of the car, but she had locked all the doors. Without warning, she swerved and braked. Fats, clutching the sides of his seat, saw that they were in a lay-by on the Yarville bypass. Frightened that she would order him out of the car, he turned his swollen face to her.
Your birth mother, she said, looking at him as she had never done before, without pity or kindness, was 14 years old. We had the impression, from what we were told, that she was middle class, quite a bright girl. She absolutely refused to say who your father was. Nobody knew whether she was trying to protect an underage boyfriend or something worse. We were told all of this in case you had any mental or physical difficulties. In case, she said clearly, like a teacher trying to emphasize a point sure to come up in a test, you had been the result of incest. He cowered away from her. He would have preferred to be shot.
I was desperate to adopt you, she said. Desperate. But Dad was very ill. He said to me, I can't do it. I'm scared I'll hurt a baby. I need to get better before we do this, and I can't do that and cope with a new baby as well.
But I was so determined to have you, said Tessa, that I pressured him into lying and telling the social workers that he was fine and pretending to be happy and normal. We brought you home, and you were tiny and premature. And on the fifth night we had you, Dad slipped out of bed and went to the garage, put a hosepipe on the exhaust of the car, and tried to kill himself, because he was convinced he'd smothered you. And he almost died.
So you can blame me, said Tessa, for your and Dad's bad start. And maybe you can blame me for everything that's come since. But I'll tell you this, Stuart. Your father's spent his life facing up to things he never did. I don't expect you to understand this kind of courage, but... Her voice broke at last, and he heard the mother he knew. He loves you, Stuart. She added the lie because she could not help herself. Tonight, for the first time, Tessa was convinced that it was a lie, and also that everything she had done in her life, telling herself that it was for the best, had been no more than blind selfishness, generating confusion and mess all around. But who could bear to know which stars were already dead, she thought, blinking up at the night sky. Could anybody stand to know that they all were? She turned the key in the ignition, crashed the gears, and they pulled out again onto the bypass.
I don't want to go to the fields, said Fats in terror.
We're not going to the fields, she said. I'm taking you home.
4. The police had picked up Crystal Whedon at last as she ran hopelessly along the riverbank on the very edge of Pagford, still calling her brother in a cracked voice. The policewoman who approached her addressed her by name and tried to break the news to her gently. But she still tried to beat the woman away from her, and in the end the policewoman had almost to wrestle her into the car. Crystal had not noticed Fats melting away into the trees. He did not exist to her anymore. The police drove Crystal home, but when they knocked on the front door, Terry refused to answer. She had glimpsed them through an upstairs window and thought that Crystal had done the one unthinkable and unforgivable thing and told the pigs about the holdalls full of Obbo's hash. She dragged the heavy bags upstairs while the police hammered at the door, and only opened up when she considered that it had become unavoidable.
"What you want?"
she shouted, through an inch-wide gap in the door. The policewoman asked to come in 3 times, and Terry refused, still demanding to know what they wanted. A few neighbours had begun to peer through windows. Even when the policewoman said, "It's about your son, Robbie," Terry did not realise.
"He's fine. There's nothing wrong with him. Crystal's got him."
But then she saw Crystal, who had refused to stay in the car and had walked halfway up the garden path. Terry's gaze trickled down her daughter's body to the place where Robbie should have been clinging to her, frightened by the strange men. Terry flew from her house like a fury, with her hands outstretched like claws, and the policewoman had to catch her around the middle and swing her away from Crystal, whose face she was trying to lacerate.
"You little bitch! You little bitch! What have you done to Robbie?"
Crystal dodged the struggling pair, darted into the house, and slammed the door behind her.
"Fuck's sake," muttered the policeman under his breath.
Miles away, in Hope Street, Kay and Gaia Borden faced each other in the dark hallway. Neither of them was tall enough to replace the light bulb that had been dead for days, and they had no ladder. All day long, they had argued and almost made up, then argued again. Finally, at the moment when reconciliation seemed within touching distance, when Kay had agreed that she too hated Pagford, that it had all been a mistake, and that she would try and get them both back to London, her mobile had rung.
"Crystal Whedon's brother's drowned," whispered Kay, as she cut Tessa's call.
"Oh," said Gaia, knowing that she ought to express pity, but frightened to let discussion of London drop before she had her mother's firm commitment. She added, in a tight little voice,
"That's sad." "It happened here in Pagford," said Kay, "along the road."
Crystal was with Tessa Wall's son. Gaia felt even more ashamed of letting Fats Wall kiss her. He had tasted horrible, of lager and cigarettes, and he had tried to feel her up. She was worth much